House Finance back to order, and I, as I had mentioned, we were called to order. The time is 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, March 12th, 2019. Present today, we have Representative Knopp, Representative Tilton, Representative Johnston, Co-Chair Wilson, Representative Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick. Are you online? No, she's okay. She was online. She should be calling back. Representative LeVon is currently in a subcommittee meeting right now. And so with that, myself also, Co-Chair Foster. As we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And today the committee will hear the budget overview for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'd like to invite OMB Budget Director Lacey Sanders and Administrative Services Director Sana Eford to the table. And I'd like to let the committee know that the commissioner designee Adam Crum is also here and in the audience as a resource for the committee if policy questions do arise. Thanks for being here. Ms. Sanders and Ms. Eford, if you could please put yourselves on the record, and to help with recording of the minutes, just a reminder, if you could just state your name if we have a little bit of back and forth between the both of you. And so with that, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders. I'm the Budget Director for the Office of Management and Budget.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Sana Eford. I am the Administrative Services Director for Health and Social Services.
And as Representative Foster mentioned, we're going to walk through the Department of Health and Social Services budget overview, starting with slide number 3.
Again, this is Sana Eford. Our first slide, we wanted to show the committee members currently what the core services for the Department of Health and Social Services are. And as you can see, there are 7 core services. This was an exercise that the department went through about 5 years ago. That was with a results-based budgeting effort that we were working together with all divisions. This is an exercise with the new commissioner administration that we will do again, probably during the summer, to see if the core services are still reflective of our department's priorities. And as you can see, for those 7 core services, we've aligned the total budget in how, again, currently the budget is aligned to meet those core services.
I'd just like to recognize Representative Merrick. Are you online? Representative Merrick, are you there? Oh, okay. Well, I just for the record, she had called in at the very start of the meeting, and sounds like there might be some technical difficulties. Representative Johnston?
Yes, thank you to the chair. The managed health care coverage, is that United Technologies, or is that just managed health care?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston. No, that does not have a relationship to the managed care organization. This is, as I said, a core service that we feel like all of our divisions, or which divisions through their budget, contribute to meeting this service for Alaskans.
Thank you.
And again, I would like to point out the mission of the department on this page is to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. We, both the health and the public welfare, are all called out for our department in Article 7 of the Constitution, Section 4 and 5.
And we've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Eifer, for being here. Nice to see you again. Appreciate the list of core services here, and then the dollar figures that go into trying to meet each of those different areas of core services. However, there isn't really, when you say core services, the definition is there, but without a list of actual programs or the appropriations that fit within each of these service definitions, it doesn't really provide me much information. So do we have some sort of backup document that lists the specific programs that match each of these different core services?
through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we do have that document, and if it has not been provided to the committee, we will provide it.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Lacey Sanders. It was provided to the co-chair's office and can be distributed as needed.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair of Finance or co-chair of Hess, which co-chair's office?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, to Representative Foster's co-chair of Finance office.
Please continue.
The next slide depicts the Department of Health and Social Services budget as compared with FY19 management plan to the FY20 governor's amended budget. On the left side is the funding for those years, and on the right is the position count. In FY19 management plan, the total for the department was $3,249,951,500 as compared to the governor's FY20 proposed amended of $2,468,798,400. This is a difference of $781,153,100, which is about a 25% reduction in the total department budget. For the FY20 budget proposed, the makeup of our budget is about 58% federal funding at $1,439,683,000, 5% of other funds, which the largest portion of that are interagency receipts, and 36% of our budget is general funds, which is made up of 90% UGF and 10% designated general funds. And the large portion of designated general funds are Pioneer Home receipts from residents for room and board, child support collections in foster care base rate, background check and application fees through our residential licensing programs, and birth and death certificate fees collected in vital statistics. On the right side of the slide are the budgeted position comparison, and an FY19 management plan compared to FY20 governor's amended. The difference, 291 positions. The bulk of those positions are reflected in the Alaska Psychiatric Institute reorganizational structure change. All the positions are now, the funding and positions are reflected, the funds in the contractual line and the positions with the reorganization reflected under a contract. The other large portion, or the other portion of positions that are being deleted, are associated with the Nome Youth Facility. There are 16 positions there, 11 which are filled, which would be layoffs or would be transfers for those positions.
Got a question, Representative Knopf, and then Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the budget, back one slide, on the budget comparisons, is a $400 million loss in federal dollars. Is that a direct relationship to the loss of the general fund dollars? Is that matching, or why the reduction?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, that is correct. The majority of those funds are with the Medicaid program.
So follow up. So it looks like general fund dollars is down roughly $300 million, and then we're about $400 million down in federal dollars.
Representative Knopf, through the chair, the next slide shows the changes in those funding sources, but that is correct.
And one more follow-up. So that's almost dollar for dollar, roughly. I thought the rates were a little better than that. So maybe at some point you can explain that to me. I thought it was 75-25 or 90-10 or something. more proportional. It's almost 60-40 or something there. So,
through the chair, if I may, this is Lacey Sanders for the record. There are more. There are additional decreases that were taken in the Department of Health and Social Services that were specific to general funds that did not have the required match. So this is an overall budget picture, and you are accurate in your statement that it isn't a dollar for dollar through the Medicaid reduction that Ms. Eford was referring to. But we'll get further into those details at a later slide.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. And just for a matter of discussion, some of those drops in federal funds are actual drops, but in the department's efforts to renegotiate our position with the federal government, would it actually be as big of a drop in federal funding, or are you considering it might not be?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, for the record, this is Lacey Sanders. The department is still working through their process, working with CMS to determine what the impacts are going to be and what is what they're able to make changes to and what those impacts to the federal funds will be. My understanding is that report will be due out at the end of March.
Thank you.
And
Ms. Eford? Oh, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're going to get into more of the specific details in relationship to the later slides coming, but with the reduction of the nearly $800 million in overall budget for Health and Human Services, can you kind of give me a summary of where you see the opportunity costs are in relationship to the department to be able to meet its mission to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans? In other words, can you kind of summarize? So we're expending $800 million total less dollars for the program. Not total, I mean it's a little less than that. There must be some sort of general statement you can make about what's the opportunity cost of that increase or that decrease in spending.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, again, as we go through the details, you will see exactly which programs the department has put forward in their proposal for reductions. There are some reductions within the budget that hit various populations, but what the department tried to do, as I'll go over, why don't we go on to the next slide? And I'll just show, as I'm sure you've heard, the budget was based on our governor's core tenets that we were given as we were putting our budget together. And our direction was to focus on our core services, that our expenditures cannot exceed existing revenue, to maintain and protect our financial reserves, that our budget does not take additional funds from Alaskans through taxes or the PFD, and that it must be sustainable, predictable, and affordable. As we look through the different reductions that I'll go over with you, we took these things into consideration, and we tried to balance the programs that we were reducing with other areas that those constituencies are receiving other funding sources. But it's not a flat budget, so there are reductions and will be effects.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the commissioner.
Commissioner, would you mind coming up and if you could put yourself on the record, and thanks for making yourself available.
Oh, thank you, Representative Foster. For the record, my name is Adam Crum. I'm the commissioner of Department of Health and Social Services.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So underneath what the core portions of this, expenditures cannot exceed existing revenue. One of the biggest issues that we've had is a supplemental anywhere from a couple $100 million and growing, depending upon what the year is. I'd just like to find out how you are going to do things differently so that we're able to hit this moving target.
Thank you, Representative, through the chair. As we approach this, we will have much more detail in the coming weeks on this. I agree that the asking for the large supplementals over each of the last couple of years is quite a shock to the legislatures. They have to deal with the previous part. So as we put together this plan, we'll have a little bit more specific detail for you so we can actually avoid that. As we're working towards this in the future, that is part of our main goal as a department, is to make sure we get as accurate a projection as possible.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So we have to deal with our federal partners. Do you have any idea at this point what the timetable would be as far as some of the different changes from the maintenance of effort to decreasing things that, even if we change legislation, that it has to also have their approval? Any idea how long that may take?
Representative, through the chair. So as we approach this process, currently Deputy Commissioner Stewart is actually in D.C. right now, excuse me, meeting with CMS. We're actually trying to navigate and try to get timelines on when these can be implemented. And one of our goals as we present our numbers is a little bit of an amortized schedule about when we actually think they can be in place and the effects thereof. So we're not giving you a hopeful number. We're trying to give you as accurate as possible.
One last question. And is it possible that quite a few of these ideas that you have in here might actually be able to be implemented by July 1st?
Representative, through the chair, yes, we will actually have a substantial number we'll be able to implement for FY20.
Thank you.
Before we get too far away from slide four, with regard to your position counts, I just want to thank the commissioner and Ms. Seaford for stopping in and making themselves available regarding the Nome Youth Facility. And I think you had mentioned that there is a cut of 11 positions here. Is that, for some reason I was thinking there were actually 13 that would be leaving Nome, but does that mean that two would have to be picked up elsewhere?
Chair Foster, two of those positions are currently vacant. So the positions will go away, but they are not filled currently at this time.
Sorry, that's Eford.
Eford, that's fine.
Thank you. Okay, and I just wanted to, I guess, throw this out there that in our discussions, I guess it was our feeling that there might not be the savings that I think the governor's budget was maybe hoping for, and I think we'll be working through that through the subcommittee process and also in our dialogue with the administration. So I just wanted to make sure that the folks back home who might be watching know that we are we're paying attention to this and we're working on it. So with that, are there any other questions? Representative Josephson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For whomever is in the best position to answer, we did get a little bit ahead of ourselves, and so I'm not going to leave too far away from that. But on the Medicaid reduction, you've indicated that you'd give us some more detail, and the detail I need to know is, first of all, my understanding of the 1115 waiver system is that you have to show, broadly speaking, an alternative means of achieving a federal goal or statutory goal, and I'm just wondering how you can cut $225 million and do that. And I don't have any indication, at least in this PowerPoint, who's going to get hurt in the process. So I need to know more than there's just going to be this cut and somehow it will all work out. And at this point, I don't have that. And to be asked to vote ultimately on the governor's proposal, I would absolutely need that. And also need a better understanding of how you've indicated a letter in late March, but how that is going to sort of evolve into a budgetary component before sort of mid-June when we get close to the edge. And if someone could respond to that, that would be helpful.
Ms. Sanders?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, and I have two lifelines next to me that can jump in as well. The information that you're going to be receiving, regarding the Medicaid changes is going to be substantial. It's not going to just be a memo or a letter. There will be details attached with the impacts and the changes that are being proposed. That is forthcoming. We understand that you need that information as a committee to make decisions. At the same time, I would anticipate from a technical perspective that we would put forward any budget-related amendments to address the changes that would be necessary in providing a plan that goes along with that proposal that's going to be put forward. So technical budget amendments along with detailed information on what the path is moving forward.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, please continue. We're at a break here. Representative Merrick, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you. And we know that you were with us from the very start, and I think the calls were being dropped, so thanks for being with us. Please
thank
continue.
You.
So again, slide five just shows the changes in the budget by funding source from 19 to 20, the percentage changes and difference in those funding sources. The next slide, as we said, I just want to go over the highlights of the large general fund budget changes within the budget. The first one I'd like to point out is within the Alaska Pioneer Homes division. A couple of things in this division. First, there's been a budget structure change, which is reflected with a new budget component for a payment assistance component. Currently, the budget for Pioneer's Home, the payment assistance is really wrapped up within the Pioneer Homes component itself, and it's difficult to see how the payment assistance supplements the payments. So we have reduced in the Pioneer Homes budget the general funds, replacing part of those general funds in another component, budget component called payment assistance of $15 million in general funds, and increased the designated general funds, which would be to receive fees from increasing the rates in the Pioneer Homes. What I'd like to preface this with, the proposal put before you in the governor's budget does not evict residents from the Pioneer Homes. I want to make sure we say that clearly at first, and then to say that we are proposing to put forth regulations to increase the rates that actually show what the true cost of care for each of the levels of care in the Pioneer Homes. And that's what's reflected in the governor's budget proposal for Pioneer Homes.
Representative Wilson, and then Josephson, and then Ortiz.
I'm a little confused that just as far as to implement the rates. You have $16,792,000 general fund, and then is this an additional $16,386,000 general fund mental health, which is still general fund money? So are we adding those two together to start with?
Those, through the chair, Representative Wilson, those are the reductions because both of those were general funds. So the Pioneer's Home budget was originally around $33 million in general funds. That has been reduced, but $15 million of it has now actually been shifted to a payment assistance budget component of general funds. So it's shown in a different way, but there is a reduction in the general fund component for Pioneer, the UGF component, that has been replaced with additional designated general funds for the increase in the rates to collect those fees.
Follow up?
Usually they have a negative sign, so are there
I'm sorry.
I got confused on that. I thought that's what they were.
In this presentation, I apologize. So in parentheses are negatives, and the other additions have no parentheses. So you'll see payment assistance, $15 million general fund, that was added as a budget structure change, and then the two reductions.
So the follow up on the DGF on the previous page shows an increase of $11,358,000. Yet it sounds like the DGF has a potential of being over $16 million when it comes to the Pioneer Homes. Why is there about a $5 million difference between the two?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. The slide that you're seeing is the overall total for the entire department. And so with technical budget changes, changes in other components that may have been related to other reductions, I know there's some SB 74 reductions that included designated general funds. There are lots of technical adjustments that add up to the total in the budget, but this is the biggest portion of DGF, but there's some offsetting decreases in other components in the DGF.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Probably what a lot of people at the Pioneer Home want to know, do we have any idea, because I know that if you're paying your way there, then no financials are required, and nor should they if they're paying their own way. So how did this particular amount come to be as far as knowing who your residents were on whether or not this could end up being a $16 million cut because maybe they'll end up being on assistance because it may throw it over the side. I'm just trying to figure out how that came about for this amount and how sure are you that this doesn't end up actually being, a decrement to the Pioneer Home.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. We are still looking at the numbers for the Pioneer Home and doing that analysis. Currently, we know that we have 451 filled beds in all the Pioneer Homes. We have 51% of those on private pay currently, but that's under the current structure where everyone in the home is actually being subsidized because they don't pay the cost of care for each of the levels of care. 29% are currently on payment assistance and 20% are under a Medicaid waiver. And so we are still looking at the number. We started with $15 million. The Pioneer Homes financial unit is actually trying to look at and make an estimate and a projection of calculations if we have the right number or if there may be a change in that number.
Thank you.
And I'd like to recognize, we're joined by Representative LeBon, who is in a subcommittee finance meeting. So thanks for coming in. We've got Representative Josephson, Ortiz, Tilton, and Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Why is the, or how is the $15 million payment assistance a sustainable line item for us?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it is the cost of taking care of our seniors in the Pioneer Home. And this was a policy decision of something that we wanted to continue funding.
Follow-up? Through the chair, I did some just basic math, that's all I'm generally capable of. And the $30 million subsidy is 0.2% of the deficit. So in my mind's eye, 0.2% to help 500 seniors seems like money well spent. You want to pay $15 million, that seems like 0.1%. Why don't we just continue doing what we're doing and just say it's for the benefit of 500 Alaska families? It's a policy call. I just want to know why, in the great scheme of things, while all math matters and everything is additive, why should we make this one?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, for the record, Lacey Sanders. I think the point the administration is trying to make is that we are subsidizing a large cost that private pay insurance or Medicaid may be able to cover the cost and that we should be accessing those costs if we are able to. There is value in supporting and subsidizing so that we ensure no seniors are removed from the home. But with the fiscal situation that we're in, we need to address the state's costs. And I think this budgetary change outlines the true cost to the state and what the state is putting forward. And it provides clarity
And as Ms. Eford mentioned, the $15 million was an estimate based on information that we had. As Representative Wilson mentioned earlier, we don't have all the financial information on every person in the home, but we are continuing to analyze the numbers and make sure that we are putting forward a sufficient number that covers the costs.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, if I may. So under the long-term plan, is it safe to say that that $15 million will gradually be going down from year to year to year, or am I incorrect in that assumption?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, again, it will be based on the makeup of the seniors that are in the home each year. And so, again, it'll be prior year information that we're working from. As you know, seniors leave the homes and then new residents come in. So I don't really foresee that it would be going down, but I'm not sure yet, like we had said, if we had the exact right number to manage the population and the need in the Pioneer homes.
Representative Ortiz.
That. You mentioned earlier, and I was glad to hear it, that no residents will be, no current residents will be removed from the Pioneer home if they were unable to afford these increasing rates. What does that say about as new applicants come into the, new applicants find beds available to them in the Pioneer home, will they will be looking at the current raised rates, correct? And it very well may be that if this change were to occur, that we would make the Pioneer home inaccessible to many lower-income seniors. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we have a wait list, as you know, for residents coming into the home. We have an active wait list and an inactive wait list. I think about 250 plus are on the active wait list. When someone puts their name on the active wait list, I believe it's they anticipate within the next 30 days they would be ready to go in within the home. I might have the number wrong. It might be a little bit longer, but they're more current and ready to enter. We do not look at income or information before they are taken into the home. So their entrance into a Pioneer home is not based on their ability to pay or not pay.
Currently,
and
will that continue to be the case in the future?
Through the chair, yes, that is the intention.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just the rate structure that we had talked about a little bit in the subcommittee. Could you just go into a little bit of detail how you're changing the different levels of care so that we can help the rest of the committee to see how that rate structure will change a little bit?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, we do, and we can provide a table that shows the changes. Currently, there are three levels of care within the Pioneer homes. We are proposing with these changes to go to five levels of care, and so we can provide the changes in that. One of the levels, level five, is currently not a level that the Pioneer homes are able to care for, but we are working on developing a nine-bed unit in the Anchorage Pioneer home that will actually take care of a higher acuity level of patients that need their complex behavior concerns with those patients, and really nowhere is can take them currently, so we're looking at actually adding this level of care. And the basic change is our current level two I think we're breaking out into a level two and a three to really be careful that we're distinguishing the types of services that each of the residents are paying for in those levels. But we will be happy to get you that table.
Thank you. And a second question.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the second question is that the payment assistance would be available to all of those who are entering into the home, no matter what type of pay that they are on?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, that is correct. We, if a resident does need to go on payment assistance, they are required currently by regulation, and I'll have to check and see if that is actually by statute, to provide their income information so that the home can, we can calculate exactly the amount of assistance they will need.
Got Representative Johnston, Sullivan Leonard, and Ortiz. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I appreciate what the administration is doing here. This was an effort that I became aware of in the past administration, that this is an ongoing effort, and so I appreciate it. And the subcommittee, it was mentioned that the average, and I might have this correct or wrong, average age of new residents is 87. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I think coming in, I think the average age might be 81, but I think those coming into level three, the average age is 87.
Thank you for the clarification. So my point is that the service, the amount of care could be more acute. And particularly in the level five, once we get that up and going. And it will be amount of care that will, with some residents, be assisted with Medicaid. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
So my first question, with the general fund decrement that you've made, according to Medicaid, have you taken into account maybe the increased cost of this level of care or the amount of Medicaid that might be required in the Pioneer Home?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, as we were saying with what's going to be forthcoming for the Medicaid plan, we are looking at all groups that would be affected by various proposals that might come through this and what that would look like.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up? My other question is, and I appreciate the payment assistance, and I understand why you've got a $15 million figure out there, but you're not sure if that's going to be adequate. So we could be looking at a supplemental if this isn't the right amount. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, for the record, Lacey Sanders. Our hope is that we are not coming before this committee with supplementals in the future. This number may need to be adjusted before the process ends if the department is able to calculate and provide information that documents a greater need. But the intention is that we would have the number before you in the amount that is necessary to get through the fiscal year.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I just want to say, you know, to the commissioner, thank you for being here. And I want to commend you and the department for really looking at reducing the budget for HESS by 25%, especially in light of the fact that the last 4 years we've seen incredible increases in programs that just haven't been sustainable. So I just wanted to first off say thank you. Secondly, I did want to talk about the Alaska Pioneer Homes. In Palmer, we have the Palmer Pioneer Veterans Home. Is there any discussion with regard to transitioning, for example, that facility from a Pioneer Home to a Veterans Home, where the Veteran Administration dollars could come in to help cover the cost, which we know covers much more than Medicaid does. Is there any discussion in that by chance?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we do receive the veterans' payments come into that Pioneer Homes because it is a certified veterans' Pioneer Home facility.
Correct. Through the chair?
Representative.
I guess my question is, are you looking to possibly transition it maybe to have it 100% capacity of veteran patients?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, veterans are one of the primary population there, the Palmer Home. We haven't explored going completely to a veteran population. We like the Alaska residents in there as well. But one thing we are exploring is actually creating a designated unit for an advanced level of care at the Pioneer Home, which actually would be a greater portion of federal funding through the VA.
I think that's what I was looking for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Representative Ortiz.
Earlier, Ms. Eifert, I believe you said that Pioneer Homes currently have a total of 451 filled beds. Do you know what the total capacity is in the Pioneer Home system? What percentage of, do you know what the capacity is?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, there are a total of 496 licensed beds in the homes, and the department has been working over the last 2 years to increase and to meet a 95% occupancy rate because that's the industry standard, and we are approaching that. The Fairbanks Pioneer Home just recently hit their 95% occupancy rate, and we're working to meet that target in each of the homes.
Follow up.
Would you characterize the falling short of that number so far as being a result of just the general time it takes, frictional change when one person moves out versus another person coming in, or is it more of an issue of lack of adequate funding to fill staff so that they can actually staff the beds?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the 95% really tries to take in account the who's leaving and who's coming in, thus not 100% there. In years past, the Pioneer Home has received a number of cuts, and those cuts actually did reduce staffing. I think over the past 5 years, they've lost about 23 plus full-time positions, and the administration at that time chose to meet that cut by closing beds. Consequently, this administration has determined that what you're actually doing, if you close a bed, you're not receiving your income there, so you're kind of a double whammy on your resources. So instead, we are going the other way to fill the beds, thus the income would be coming in and need the staffing then to staff those beds.
Representative or Ms. Sanders?
May I also add through the chair, Representative Ortiz, to address another concern about the percentage of beds filled. A lot of the wait lists are location specific, which may hinder the department's ability to fill those beds in specific areas.
And any further questions? Representative Tilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you also say that some of the challenge in filling the beds is having the beds available for the level of care that is needed and making sure that that you have the right proportion of rooms to that level of care?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, absolutely. And as Representative Johnston was sharing, more of the residents coming into the Pioneer Homes need the higher level care. Because they are higher acuity levels. And so it is staffing up for those different needs also affects that.
Please continue with the presentation.
The next budget item that we'd like to point out is a change in the budgeting for Alaska Psychiatric Institute. As I shared before, you will note in the budget proposal from the governor that there has been an organizational restructuring. Therefore, all the money from all of the line items in Alaska Psychiatric Institute is now showing in the contractual line to adjust to the organizational restructuring. It shows positions being zeroed out, and this will be a different way of managing the Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Got a question from Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. This is probably more of a question to OMB, but with the 248 positions that will be now taken out of the state's employment pool, what effect will that have on the PERS unfunded liability? I just, coming from an employer position in the past where we've had to have termination studies, and I realize the state doesn't need to have a termination study, but is this accounted somewhere in the budget as far as this decrement of employees?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I am not an expert in the field of retirement actuarials and the outcomes of what changes PCN counts may have on that. What I can say is that the employees that were working as state employees are eligible and due the benefits that they have earned during their time as state employees. Those would end as they would be no longer state employees. So the out year benefits due to them would no longer be accounted for. But what they have earned, they would be eligible for.
I don't know if Director Ardwin, I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that. Did you want her to?
A follow-up. It's more these positions, the state will not be paying for these positions going forward as far as how it affects the overall pension funds. And if you want to do this offline or if you have an answer today, it'd be great.
Representative Johnston, through the chair, we can follow up with you and have a conversation about those impacts with experts that can answer your question.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this item, if you don't recall, I know that this has been discussed in a lot of different settings in the building, but the $28 million transfer to contractual services, what is the all-in anticipated expense of the privatizing of API, if we know that? So in this, including their per diem, and is there a single number that I can rely on?
Ms. Euford?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there is, as you know, a current contract that for FY19 with some deliverables that need to be met in order to continue with that contract in FY20. The contract is posted online. The total of that contract is different numbers, so again, we may be coming back with a different number associated with this change for API.
Okay, just to follow up, is there a rough cut that you can give me now that I won't, I promise not to hold you to? Is it $38 million?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the contract, I believe, is, and I think it's around $43 million. That is not all general funds, and that's part of what we're making sure, again, to calculate correctly, because currently the bed number in API that's open is only 30, and I'm not sure today, but generally around 35. We are working to open 80 beds, which could produce more Medicaid funds or other coverage of funds. So we, again, are looking at what is the breakout of the funding sources needed for the coverage for FY20 for API.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps, Ms. Eber, this is what you were getting at in your
through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the correct amount is not in the FY20 governor's proposal yet, and we are looking at what that number would be to probably bring forward a change for that budget request.
And is it a safe assumption that the request is going to increase rather than decrease?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the privatization of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, is it WellPath that is the contractor that will take on this facility? And if so, what does the state anticipate then for savings?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. For the record, this is Adam Crum. Yes, WellPath is the name of the contractor. Now, as we look towards this, it's a long-term cost avoidance as well. There will be savings as well that, because they can bring the hospital back up to full capacity, and so we're going to actually be able to serve more of the population, which is going to have a cost avoidance throughout the rest of the system. Currently, a lot of patients are sitting in emergency departments, which is a higher cost on the Medicaid side, and so we'll be able to treat them much faster, as well as hopefully increase the size of our forensic unit, which will actually more rapidly move individuals from Department of Corrections so they can be properly evaluated to stand trial.
Follow-up?
But we don't have a dollar amount yet, is what you're saying.
Through the chair. No, not yet. This is, we're trying to put those together. We can have some projections. We know roughly what the fines and the cost of decertification would be in items such as that. But we do know it'll be a tremendous amount.
Further questions? Seeing none, please.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
The commissioner and I respect the goal of avoiding emergency room expenses and getting people where they should be. And it just reminds me of the Medicaid cut itself and the cost that could be associated with shifting care to the emergency room. And I just hope that when we hear more from CMS that issue is covered. Thank you.
And Representative Knopp.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Crum, I don't want really specifics. I'm just kind of general. So, if you do a $43 million appropriation to contract out the services, then WellPath will do all the billings for the Medicaid and private, and then are them revenues funneled back to the state, or are they just spent and then contract money not paid out, or how does that process work?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, this is Santa Eford. We would bill for all other funding sources through WellPath, or the contractor would be paid their amount. But all other funding sources that could be recouped would be recouped through. And I don't know the details. If WellPath would do that, I'm assuming the department would be doing that, rebilling for the Medicaid payments.
Follow up? So that function of administrative services, do you know, is there other functions of administrative services that the department will still be doing, even though it's privatization at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the WellPath is managing the clinical aspects for API. The department would still be doing the maintenance of the building, utilities, those things.
Follow up. So then we would expect to see in a light item somewhere indirect expenditures in that regard. Would that be fair to say?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, please continue.
The next highlight for our budget that I'd like to point out that we do have increased federal awards that are coming into the department to meet the opioid crisis or the opioid challenge that all states are facing. And so there are some federal grants coming into public health and into behavioral health for the opioid funding. And I believe, as this points out, some additional grants for public health and epidemiology. One portion of this I'd like to point out is that there is a work group that's collaborating, a state group that includes, I believe, public safety and corrections also, because there are opioid funding coming into those areas too. So we want to make sure that we're looking at a very cohesive, collaborative way to use this funding.
Representative Ortiz.
And would this be looked at as one-time funding, or is this an ongoing funding source that you think we'll have?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I don't know the specifics of each of these, but generally the federal grants are multi-year, but I do not have the details on each one, but we can get that for you.
Please continue.
The next bullet point is, as we talked about a little bit earlier, in the Nome Youth Facility, the governor's proposal is to retain the youth probation services in Nome, but we would be moving the youth that needed detention and treatment services to other facilities within the state system, McLaughlin or another facility for their treatment and detention.
Representative Johnston.
Thank you. Through the chair, has the department looked into partnering as far as this detention and treatment services with maybe the IHS facility? Can't think of the name of the hospital. Yes.
Representative Johnston, through the chair. This is Adam Crum, for the record. Yes, we're exploring the interest of regional partners of possibly doing something else with the facility, not necessarily using it as a youth facility, but perhaps use it as a substance abuse treatment center. We do believe there might be possible funding mechanisms through the 1115 SUD, that's the substance use disorder waiver that we have. And so this is something that's an ongoing talk. We believe there's a little bit of interest, but it's an ongoing negotiation. This would be something that would be a very valuable item in that section of Alaska.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess, youth facility can mean those who have just maybe need a little bit more parenting. That didn't happen to those who are in, some very severe trouble. What is the makeup of the youth facility, and about how many people on average are there, how many youth?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I apologize. I don't have that direct number. I know it's I can hedge a guess, 50 to 60% capacity, kind of rotating through there. But when we say the youth facility on the juvenile justice side is what I was referring to, I apologize.
Follow-up? So 50% doesn't mean a whole lot to me if I don't know how much the capacity is. And I am just talking about the youth portion of it. And I guess the reason I'm asking, the severity of it, is there, not necessarily use in the hospital or anything like that, but I know we talked about this extensively several times throughout the years with that in Ketchikan as well, on, whether or not it's almost kind of an overkill as far as how many people have to be there for a handful of people versus, I hate to use the foster system as part of it, but a type of where it would be a fostering type situation if we weren't talking about violent offenders, but more that you want to keep them, in the community because they need to stay connected. Hopefully they've learned their lesson, but yet we haven't sent them to Anchorage or Fairbanks or somewhere where, family can't be there. But without understanding the level of the offenses, can you really look at those kind of ideas? So maybe they could just get back to us, but I'm pretty sure, Mr. Chairman, we talked about this before where that was a possibility that they could have used it kind of like the foster system or a group home type situation where you didn't have to have, because I was remembering there was only like four or five youth at a time, and the cost really was because it didn't matter whether there was 50 or five or six, you still had to have the year, the round the clock help, including health and all the rest of those, and all that money could have really been poured into the youth instead and being able to get the help. So I would just hope by this point, because it's got to be at least 4 years we've talked about this, that the department at some point would really come up with a solution, because I don't think this is probably the only community, luckily, that has the problem of having so few that it's not cost effective. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Commissioner. My lifeline just provided me that the Nome Youth Facility averages about 8 kids a day.
How many?
8 kids a day, as far as occupancy.
Sounds like a perfect group home opportunity, and maybe with treatment, with all the extra money we'll save by not having people watching just 8. I think their families have more than 8 children and done fine raising them.
Thank you. Any other questions on this? I do. So the issue here is the capacity is down some, and the state's looking at ways to save some money. And I would contend that, there are other costs, and I don't know what the real savings are here. Because if you send the kids off to places like McLaughlin or some of the other facilities throughout the state, they still have to be sent back to Nome for court hearings and so forth. So you've got travel costs, you've got the cost of the chaperone who needs to be, accompanying the youth. You've got the costs of securely holding them overnight when they go in to have their court hearing with, the courts, and with 2 flights a day, it's not always easy to just fly in the morning and leave at night. And not to mention, a lot of the weather delays that you have out there. You've also got the cost of heating the facility, because we're still going to have the probation officers that are in the building, so we're not just shutting down the building. We've got the cost of housing the kids at the other facilities. That's not just going to be a zero cost. There will be some cost there as well, and I'm sure that there's some other costs too. And I guess even if we assume that, there are some savings there, there's still the policy issue, and that is, this governor has made public safety a real priority, and I think closing down the youth facility, I think this could help in that endeavor. But I know that this is something, again, that we can work with our subcommittee members on and with the administration here. And I do want to say I really appreciate the fact that, you all have reached out to me and wanted to explain some of the issues that you're having to deal with, and they're all tough decisions all the way around, and so we'll continue to work through it. So I appreciate your being here. So with that, I guess if there's nothing else on the Nome Youth Facility, we'll move on to the next slide, I assume.
Yes, under slide 7, this is Santa Eford for the record. So the next 4 bullets are actually within the Division of Public Assistance. The first one is to reduce the adult public assistance payments by this program provides assistance payments to our age 65 and older, blind and disabled. And this, there are 2, this also provides the maintenance of effort required for our Medicaid program. This proposal is moving the maintenance of effort calculation from our current, there are 2 methodologies that you can calculate a state's maintenance of effort for their adult public assistance program. And we currently are under a total expenditure method, which means we must meet the same level of expenditures from the prior year, or we could go back to the 1983 payment levels that were in place then. And this is what this budget is proposing, which would change the payments and would be a savings of $14.7 million. The next bullet is to reduce the temporary assistance for needy families maintenance of effort. We currently provide this funding to our tribal partners who administer their own TANF, temporary assistance for needy family programs. We have 7 tribes that currently do that. This payment is a supplement to those tribes that provide the TANF program to their recipients.
This proposal is to reduce this general fund amount, maintenance of effort. In order to do this, we will have to get our federal agency to agree that we can reduce the amount of maintenance of effort for the state. So we are still working with our cognizant agency to do that.
Question, Representative Ortiz.
That proposed reduction of the $16 million, that's out of how much? Can you tell me?
Our current maintenance of effort that's required from the state is $36 million, I believe. I don't want to get my numbers mixed up. We can get all that information back to you. We have a total, it's an 80, the total for the maintenance of effort is an 80% of the total federal grant that comes into the state. And I will get that number back for you.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
The next bullet is within the governor's proposal to repeal the Hold Harmless program. And this program, as you probably know, an amount is deducted from each individual's permanent fund dividend that is then put into a Hold Harmless fund to keep public assistance recipients harmless from losing their benefits when they receive the permanent fund dividend. So the governor's proposal is to repeal that statute. So there is a bill that will be forthcoming to do this. And then looking at other ways that to mitigate the loss of those benefits through possibly providing the PFD on a monthly basis, or looking at other ways besides paying this through the PFD Hold Harmless.
Representative Wilson.
And I understand that that might be a good way of paying it, but is it still possible to actually end up kicking people off the program, those who are already on the border? And now you've increased, depending upon what the dividend, of course, you know, would make a difference. What would happen if it would, you know, maybe you're just like right underneath the amount, even $100 more a month would make it so that you're ineligible. Would that every year then they would have to wait to see what the dividend was and divide it by 12 on whether or not this year that it would take them off a lot of services that that $100 can't fix?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that could be possible. That's why we're looking at ways that could mitigate that possibility. Each of the programs have some different levels of eligibility, so it's actually trying to look at each one individually and make a determination or a projection who may or may not be over that limit.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And we're talking like a family of four, and let's say it was, you know, it was $2,000 and it would be $8,000 for the family. And that really is income. So I guess my bigger question policy-wise, because I'm not really exactly sure how it came about, but as we're counting full income to everybody else, so if I made $8,000 more, I would get, that would be taken and I would not get services. But yet someone who got $8,000 in the permanent fund would be held harmless and get the services that I wouldn't be able to get when I'm working. So is there? So I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, I understand that the reason it probably was put in is because it bumped a lot of people off, a lot of paperwork to get everybody on the next month, but I guess the bigger policy call is it really a fair policy if people can be working for it and get not be able to get the services, but yet we hold a whole other group to a different level?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we can get the information from you on the number of recipients under each program that are held harmless by this, but I believe the largest number are actually the adult public assistance payments, which are for 65 and older, and the blind and disabled. But we would get you, we can get you back that information.
It helped to understand, because I wouldn't want to take those who are working two jobs and putting them at a disadvantage to others who have chosen, possibly, not always, but not knowing what all the programs are. That would be very helpful. Thank you.
The next bullet that we would like to point out within the budget, the governor's proposal does repeal the senior benefits payment program. which currently are in FY 2018, there were 11,283 seniors and recipients on that program.
Ms. Eford, if you could just remind folks, I think there are three tiers, I believe, and the amounts paid under each of the tiers.
Representative Foster, Chair Foster, that is correct. There are three tiers currently with the reductions that had happened in the program before. Currently, they're cash payments of $76, $175, and $250, depending on the income levels for the seniors that apply for this program.
And the highest income level is what again?
I believe I have it. So an Alaska resident have income below $26,565 for a single person, a couple of $36,015. And I'm sorry, those are the only two income levels I have. I can again provide you a table on the information for the income levels for those payments.
And I think we can all get the information. I just want to let the viewing public know what we're looking at. So if you're a couple and you're a senior, as long as your income is below about $36,500, or if you're a single senior and your income is below $26,500-ish, then you're eligible for one of these three tiers. And so I just wanted to let folks kind of know what we're looking at here. Representative Ortiz?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct.
Okay, so can you tell me, and I'm sorry if it's there in front of me and I've dismissed it, so what kind of income would a person have in order to get the maximum amount? And we're talking monthly amounts, correct?
Through the chair, that's an annual amount. Annual, $36,000. Oh, I'm sorry, the payment. I'm sorry, excuse me. The payment is monthly. Payment's monthly. So the income level for the highest payment for an individual is $11,385, and for a married couple, it's $15,435.
Can you tell me of the 19,000 roughly recipients, is that what you said there was?
11,283. That was in FY18. We don't have the full set yet for 19.
How many of that 11,000 fall under that category of receiving the maximum payment?
I think I have this information. The number and percent of seniors at each payment level, $250, $1,742, the $175 payment, $5,124, and the $76 payment, there are $4,713. And again, that was in FY18.
Follow
up? Other than basic overall goal of meeting the core tenants, and of which one is not to exceed revenue, et cetera. Was there, for this specific reduction, was there any other research or looking into the impacts of those reductions on the actual recipients before that decision was made?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, absolutely. This is a very difficult decision and a proposal to put forward. But the department, and I would be happy to provide this to the committee also, we tried to look at all the array of services that go to each of our population groups, so for our seniors. And we looked at that array of services, and on looking at which one, and of course, low-income seniors need help. And as I said when I prefaced the budget, yes, there are impacts within this budget to individual groups. However, we wanted to keep and hold harmless some of the other larger programs that are providing funding for seniors to stay in their home, the waiver services, and as I said, I would be happy to provide the array of services that seniors are receiving across the Department of Health and Social Services that, again, we tried to look at and balance off. This was a total unrestricted general fund pot of money.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also would like to know which programs benefiting seniors were held harmless, if I could get that as well. You said, through the chair, you said that the monies were completely general fund. Is there no match for TANF?
Ms. Eford.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I was referring to the senior benefit program as all general funds.
Representative Josephson.
How many of these programs, I mean, on page 7 alone, there are a number of these that could benefit seniors, and they're all reduced or repealed. Would a senior be eligible for multiple programs on this page at the same time?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, they could be. So I do have a list, so I can read out other programs that seniors do receive funding through. Under the adult public assistance, we have 65 and above seniors, and we can provide the numbers receiving benefits under that program. We have the temporary assistance payments that seniors receive. We have general relief assistance payments, heating assistance payments, and supplemental nutrition, SNAP or food stamp payments that seniors receive. These are just the programs right there that are in public assistance. We also have the Medicaid programs and the Medicaid waivers and behavioral health funds and other funds. And as I said, I would be happy to provide this set of services broken down for seniors.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, just a couple follow-ups on this slide, Mr. Chairman. Can the administration explain what the 1983 standard is? For example, I don't know if that's a section in the federal code or a calendar year, or I don't know what the standard is.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that was the total amount of the adult public assistance payments that went out from the state in 1983. And again, I can provide you with an information sheet on next calculations. It's the federal government gives us two options to meet this requirement of maintenance of effort. And it's either to go back to the amounts that the state was funding at that time in 1983, or to meet each year we would have to meet the current level of payment for the following year.
And follow up. Is that obviously the 1983 numbers is inflation adjusted, I assume.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I will have to double check on that. I believe it does include cost of living adjustments, but I want to double check that.
And my final question, Mr. Chair, if I could, on this slide is, The temporary assistance for needy families, I'd like to know, unless you know it offhand, how much money is foregone in federal match by this cut?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the state would, if we did not meet our maintenance of effort, we would be fined that amount and would have to still meet that level of payment from state funds to receive the federal award.
I think I follow. If I could, I think what Josephson. The administration is saying is that we would know if it wasn't met, that we would be fined and the payments wouldn't be coming at all, effectively. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we would be fined. We would still get our federal award. I think part of it may, at some point, the award would be reduced in that 1 year. We would have to make it up with our general fund fine to them. But I then do believe that we would receive the same grant, federal award, in the next year, the following year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I've got a question, let's see, or first, the summary chart that you're referencing regarding the senior programs, if you could go ahead and provide that to my office, and we'll distribute that to the committee. And also, with regard to, you mentioned that the we provide heating assistance payments. I believe that the state program has gone away, but we still accept federal money, and we distribute that. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Foster, you are correct. There are no state funds there, but it's a federal.
Thank you. Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we've been a while on this slide, so I'll try not to keep you here. But I wasn't really paying attention, and I want to follow up on something I heard Rep. Josephson ask in your response. So in regards to the senior benefit payment program, that would typically end that program there. But you said that, so clarify, did you say that there were some of the seniors receiving that benefit are more than likely receiving other benefits from some of these other programs as well? Is that true or not?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, yes, there would be some overlapping. I don't have the number exactly in front of me, but I believe we can provide. I think I have a chart that shows how many seniors are receiving senior benefits and are in the other programs.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So those who are receiving senior benefits now and not receiving any other benefit would maybe qualify for something. And so I would imagine the criteria for adult public assistance would be different than it is for the senior benefit program. I think now if you're a senior, 62, 65, you're receiving the benefit based on income. That's what's left of the longevity bonus program, I believe. Is that what that senior benefit program is?
Ms. Eifert?
Chair, Representative Knopf, it was formally that, but then it was changed to a needs-based low-income program.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what it's not a lot of money they receive on the senior benefit program. So for those who are severely impacted by that going away, I guess really what I'm trying to get is there another program they're going to be eligible for to help them? And I think what I don't know is eligibility for those other programs. So I think I will probably just follow up with you at a later time on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions? Please proceed.
The last bullet on this page is to reduce public health nursing, a $2 million general fund reduction. And this reduction proposal in the governor's budget will be realized through exploring other efficiencies and leveraging their federal funding, piloting innovative service delivery models with other partners as they're working together to provide those services.
Representative Ortiz.
With this, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With this particular reduction, how will that look in terms of, will it mean reduction in nurses in particular communities, or how are we going to carry out this $2 million reduction? What's it going to look like?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. We are looking, again, at partners that could provide those services if there would be a reduction in any public health nursing services in a community. We are not proposing closing any additional public health nursing centers with this. However, looking at how can we provide the services in a more innovative way, a different way, or looking at partners in different communities that could help us with that.
And before we move to the next slide, I just want to let the committee know that Albert Wall is online, Deputy Commissioner. I believe he's the API expert. And so if there is anybody who had any questions on that between now and the end of committee, he's available. So with that, please proceed, Ms. Eifert.
The next page 8, as you can see, the bullet, of course, talks about the largest UGF portion. Medicaid is the largest percentage of our budget, UGF. It's over 60% of the department's budget. In FY19, it was $662,118,000 of general funds as compared to FY19, which is at $412,901,000 general funds, almost a $250 million reduction in general funds in this program. Through this, as you heard the commissioner speak, and I believe he could speak a little bit more on what we're working on, but we are looking to implement current initiatives within our budget that we have control over, that we feel like we can achieve in FY20. And our deputy commissioner, as he stated, Donna Stewart, is currently in Washington working with CMS right now to look at other waiver possibilities or what other options the state may entertain to look at more innovative ways to cover our vulnerable populations in the state.
Questions on Medicaid? Representative Wilson.
So I got some information on Medicaid and why we're at a 50-50, and some of it is the ability of the state to pay. Do you know if our permanent fund, the corpus as well as the earnings reserve, does that actually work against us as far as when they're trying to figure out how much the state can pay? For some of them, it's 75% federal, 25% state, and we are at the lowest amount at 50-50.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I know that the calculation is based on a per capita. I cannot answer whether the PFD is included in that, but I can get that information back to you.
I'd appreciate that because I looked at it. We looked at possibly even doing a resolution asking for that, but I'm pretty sure if a permanent fund is actually included, it would make us look very, very rich as far as, you know, per capita, not necessarily whether we could spend that or not. But, you know, if there's some way that we can actually benefit in and get that rate up, that would definitely keep the services in place, but also keep us less, hold us more harmless.
Okay, we've got questions. Representative Josephson and then Ortiz.
Thank you, through the chair, again, for whomever is best to answer, but the 225 Medicaid cut that we're hoping to obtain a waiver related to, in the event of the failure that the administration wants to spend down the SBR, in principle, I'm not objecting to that, but $172 million in the SBR is less than the cut to Medicaid, and I'm just wondering what I should make of that. So it's $51 million or so less, 53, and I just need to know what the impact of that is.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that the safety net language, so to speak, is really based on a timeline and working with CMS to get that second phase the commissioner was talking about approved. We will be forthcoming with the information about what we feel like is in our control that we will be able to achieve in FY20. We are working to achieve the governor's proposed reduction for Medicaid in FY20. Some of that is out of our control, and it's in CMS's control. And as I stated, our Deputy Commissioner Donna Stewart is there working right now. So the safety net language was there really if we were not able to work through all the deadlines and requirements with CMS to achieve that second phase of savings that we're talking about and we'll share with you.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking specifically to the bullet that says eliminate adult dental Medicaid benefit to the tune of $26 million, roughly, maybe idea what kind of numbers across the state won't be receiving any kind of dental care if this cut were to be made? And are we talking like no dental care, like basic cleaning, anything like that? Is that what we're talking?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, again, I have a chart that we have provided with the number of recipients based on age group. This is for adult preventive dental. It is those preventive dental services. However, children are still covered in the regular Medicaid program. And additionally, any emergency dental coverage or necessary would also be covered in the traditional Medicaid program. This is an optional service that, again, as we were looking at the governor's direction to the department to look at areas that we felt like, again, the Department of Health and Social Services touches people. Everything we do touches people. And everything that we look at has an impact on someone. This, again, all very difficult, hard decisions for us to make. But this is an optional Medicaid service for adults that would have coverage for any emergency dental care under regular traditional Medicaid.
I can certainly appreciate that. The question, you said you provided us numbers. Do you have access to those numbers as to the amount of adults that won't be able to continue to access even basic cleaning services if this cut were to be made?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I can't find it in all my papers, but we do have it, and we will provide it to Representative Foster's office.
Thank you.
So some of this $225 million reduction is going to be dependent on CMS approval. And then are you able to quantify how much of the reductions could be made that are considered, I guess, easier or I'm hearing a number. I'm hearing Hall talk that there's $100 million that we're pretty sure that could be achieved. I don't know if that's correct or if you can even quantify that.
Chair Foster, again, we will have that number for you as quickly as possible, and I know it's a frustrating answer, and I apologize, but again, we want to make sure that we have really looked at the information we're going to provide you and have a close estimate to what we feel like we're going to be able to achieve in 20.
Was diligently writing notes, and it sounds like this has come up. Thank you for answering it possibly twice, Commissioner.
Chair Foster, to reiterate, this is Adam Crum for the record. To reiterate that, part of the goal with Deputy Fisher Stewart being in D.C. this week is also to get affirmative on our stance on close to that number there. What is our timeline on that? And so come next week, we'll actually be able to give a very clean projection for you on that.
Very good. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody just brought up the optional programs in discussion with the dental Medicaid benefit. Are we seeing any other reductions then with the optional program or eliminations?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, again, we're looking at innovative ways that we're going to be able to cover the needs of Alaskans for their health care coverage. Currently, and I can provide a list of all the optional services currently being provided, their cost. Generally, in some of the optional services that were optional for states in the past under the Affordable Care Act actually became more mandatory, such as pharmacy, that used to be an optional service to provide medications, which is now a mandatory service under the Affordable Care Act. But we can provide that information for you. And I'm sure, as you've probably heard before, a number of optional services for Alaska are ways that we have chosen to cover what would have been a mandatory service under the federal Medicaid program, but because we were looking at our Alaska population, what was the best way to cover that service? So it is considered optional, but if we did away with some of those, it would end up being mandatory. Those are the type of things that we are making sure we're working through as we work with CMS, that we don't disrupt you know, the coverage for our low-income Alaskans for their health care, and how we can go about with other possible innovative ways to make to do that coverage in a different way.
Any further questions? Seeing none, please proceed.
Our last bullet, I think, as you've heard from each state agency, the governor is putting forward a 50% reduction in travel reduction on all funding sources, which is around $350,000 in general funds for the Department of Health and Social Services.
Representative Wilson.
This is the last piece. I have a question that has nothing to do with travel whatsoever. So the Office of Children's Services, we put a lot of money into it last year with more caseworkers, more study on the loads. And so I haven't heard any kind of update on that as far as, you know, this last year, you know, the number of children that were removed from their home, the reunification level, the, you know, the termination process. I mean, what did that money do? How many of the positions are still being held? Are we still having a turnover issue? Just some type of update of exactly what the HB 151 did and what we're seeing because of it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we will provide you additional information. I do know that, and I can't remember the, I may not have the right bill number, but I know 2 years ago they were, OCS received, or the Office of Children's Services received a number of positions. Those are all filled. The majority of those, I believe, went to the Wasilla office. They are seeing a reduction in the number of caseloads per worker in that office. We can get you information on the out-of-home children and those. The second, this last year, I think there was another group of, I believe it was like 16 additional staff for the Office of Children's Services. Those have all been filled. We have had some leave, and we are looking to fill those again. So there are still some retention concerns within the Division of Children's Services.
Follow-up? It's probably more of a commissioner question. Well, of course, the caseloads will be less if you have more people and same number of children. I would hope the caseloads, but I guess my bigger question is, policy-wise, are we going to continue to do the same thing we've been doing and having really low reunification? Or is there some type of, you know, I know you have a whole lot of things that seem to be bigger crises, but in my opinion, there's no bigger crisis than taking a child from a home that could have actually been worked out and trying to fix it later. So do you see any changes coming on the horizon, or are we just going to keep doing the same thing and hope for better results?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. This is Adam Crum for the record. Dealing with our youth and the children population, there's one of the most important things that we deal with, and especially as more data comes in about the ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, we are actually moving more and more towards how can we actually implement either family reunification aspects or working with our community partners. There's a lot of different scenarios out there that we're adjusting, and I like to say, no, our goal is not to do it just the same way we've always been. It's to gain efficiencies, to look at this, to make sure we are doing this in the best way possible for the kids and their long-term outcomes.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Sure, there's no shock to anybody on this particular topic, but this is one of these times that it's really frustrating because this group hits more than health and social services, so of course that's where all the questions come from. But, you know, not knowing whether the growth is still happening, because we're putting so much money into this system that we literally could have somebody live in the home with a parent to help them parent than what we're doing right now, because unless we have the numbers on the prosecutors, that we have, you know, when you go into the courtroom for one of these, you have the judge, you have their assistant, you have a lawyer for the mom, a lawyer for the dad, you have the OCS lawyer there, you have the OCS caseworker and a guardian ad litem, seven professionals sitting in a room just to every 15 minutes say, is there an issue? And it never seems to be an issue, except the children are still out of the home. Instead of taking that money and saying, we're going to stop doing things in silos, and I guess that's what I'm hoping with the admin assistants going all together in OMB, maybe they have these discussions. But it is really heartbreaking when you have a young couple come to your office who were taken out of their family settings, swore they would never let it happen to them, and somehow they got caught up in it. And we've been doing it for too long. And I know it's not just your problem, Commissioner, and I know you have other other ones that are probably on fire more than this, but we have broken families for so long, and for 9 years, I feel like I just keep drumming on a drum all by myself. But unless we get all the agencies together to figure out how we're going to do things differently, you're going to have more crime, you're going to have, you know, more juvenile detention, all because we didn't stop, you know, the bleeding from the very beginning. So I really encourage you to be able to not just look within your own department, but bring in those other experts, because it's hitting a whole bunch of budgets. And I know as of 2 years ago, it was probably the fastest growing program, sadly enough, and really eating away and nobody getting the help that they really needed.
Thank you. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for those comments. And I right now had a senior moment, but if the department, there's a wonderful nonprofit in Anchorage, and they have now gone to Fairbanks, and for best practices, it might be worthy a visit. Secondly, just for Representative Wilson, that she might remember, the legislation that passed last year had LBNA audit in that legislation. So I think 2018 will be the baseline for any improvement that legislation brought, or as we start looking for improvement. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Are we in our closing comments kind of time?
I believe you're done with the presentation, and so with that, if there are any, Representative Ortiz, closing comments?
Thank you, folks, for being here. You have, made a good presentation, and you had a difficult job, and appreciate the effort that you put forward here. It just has to go without saying. I mean, I just can't I can't avoid saying this. Here's the thing. What we're talking about is everybody's in agreement that we do need to have expenditures match revenue. That's without a question. We no longer have savings that we can dip into in the future. That's not a debatable thing. But what we're not saying here is, really, we're saying that we need to reduce aid to our seniors so that we can have a full PFD. We need to reduce benefits for people to be able to get access to basic medical basic dental care, so that we can have a full PFD. I mean, that's really what we're saying here. And I, for one, am just totally uncomfortable with that notion. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
I don't think that's the only thing we're saying, though. I do believe we can do business differently, and I think there are other options out there to help people get off programs, which I think we're really bad about doing once someone gets stuck into the kind of like in a circle. I've had people actually call me and try to be able to get off of it. We have hard decisions to do and to make. You're absolutely correct. But I also think there's a lot of efficiencies and a lot of money left on the table that actually make it more difficult for Alaskans to have the dream of owning their own home, having the job they want, and trying to keep some of the programs they need to be able to get there. So although I hear what you're saying, I think we also have a lot of waste that's going on and efficiencies that actually hold back Alaskans, which I don't think is ever anybody's intent.
Are there any further comments from the committee? Seeing none, anything further from the administration? I don't see any. So with that, Commissioner Crum, Ms. Sanders, Ms. Eifrid, thank you for being here. And I'm canceling the 9 a.m. meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning. Again, those meetings were scheduled as potential overflow meetings, but we have accomplished all we needed to do today. So that means our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 13th. At 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we will hear budget overviews for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and the University of Alaska. And so with that, we will be adjourned at 3:21 p.m. Thank you.